Okay, so beginning our morning with a bit of uncertainty. Yeah. It's always helpful to have real dharmas thrown into the mix. This is billed as a monastic retreat, so there's always something going wrong at the monastery as well. There's always something a little bit different at the monastery. There's always something not quite as one had thought it was going to be, planned it was going to be, conceived of how it should be. So, it's the real practice. Yeah, and I think it's helpful to recognize how we respond to, especially in the context of practice, how we respond to circumstances that are, wasn't planned for, and it's either kind of, oh dear, and shouldn't be this way, or kind of aversion, it shouldn't be this way, or kind of the great. Nothing. I can go back and sleep for another hour. There's all different possible responses, but brought into the context of our practice, how do we keep using the circumstances that we're in, and hopefully that's a quality that is, as a monastic, flavor to the retreat, to the practice. And certainly that's how we were trained in Thailand. And sometimes at the monastery I have a hard time bringing in some of the, both the uncertainty and spontaneity that really typified training at Ajahn Chah's monastery, because it's, so disconcerting for people. Yeah, sometimes you wouldn't quite know when the meetings would, when they were supposed to begin, or when they were going to end, or things like making sure you're attentive and ready to do things because you're paying attention to what's happening. And sort of like, if Ajahn Chah was going somewhere and you were supposed to be along and you weren't ready, then you were left behind. It was, and sometimes I wasn't quite sure when the heck he was actually leaving. you had to be prepared, and you had to be alert and mindful and pay attention to the situation, so that the occasions and opportunities for bringing awareness, clear comprehension, awareness and alertness to the practice, and really internalizing the practice is really important. And also, I think one of the things that is really, helpful and in a context of practice is that it's not just the methodology or the technique, but it's the quality of heart that we bring to it that's really important. We're talking at breakfast this morning, and it was mentioned that somebody's been sweeping the areas where we do walking meditation, for the monks are doing walking meditation, and that was really delightful. Or Hitesi was saying where she had put up a note saying that she's going to go and get flowers today. And in previous years, she's just gone ahead and got them. But people noticed, a variety of people noticed and made donations for the flowers. So that those are sort of things of, it's not in the routine. It's not in the strictly about paying attention to the in-breath and the out-breath. But it's application of that awareness, alertness, attentiveness, and then bringing up wholesome qualities into the heart, into the mind, And that's, you know, really as much practice as anything of the kind of the formal methodological iteration of it. There's a very interesting quote, a very short quote by Patru Rinpoche, who was a great Tibetan master in the 19th century. And he just said, "A spark of merit is worth a mountain of effort, is worth more than a mountain of effort." And, you know, usually that was, you know, what's that mean? Because, you know, we think, you know, God, the more I strive and put effort in, then the more results I should get, which is not necessarily the case in this practice. I mean, obviously, the Buddha very clearly says, yeah, this is a teaching of effort. But it's also how we apply effort. And to bring that spark of merit, and you know, merit is a lousy word. The Pali word is punya, and the Buddha says in one, you know, do not be afraid of merit. Merit is another word for happiness. Or not be afraid of punya. Punya is another word for happiness. So it says those actions, and the reason why I think Patru Rinpoche puts an emphasis on that, say that spark of merit being worth more than a mountain of effort, is the, you know, oftentimes the mountain of effort, very often it's very self-oriented, very self-willed, very me-centric. So that makes things complicated. It makes for more suffering. And, you know, a thought of and acting on the thought of helping, being of service, of giving, of sharing, of kindness, of all these seemingly ordinary actions is a stepping out of that cage of self and brightening, really brightening the heart. So that sense of recognizing, and I think, you know, particularly in a retreat setting like this, yeah, the whole world can collapse and crowd in on, you know, me and my enormous, intractable, unique and special problems. So that, you know, it can be very painful. It's not as if it's not real, but sometimes it's not a fair and balanced perspective. And then also very consciously attending to our, say, practice, extending our conception of practice so that the, yes, sitting meditation, walking meditation, it's incredibly important. But then the helping out with the particular chores that we have. Everybody has a chore. Everybody has a duty. It's our retreat. So learning how to pick up those retreat duties and use it as a part of practice, use it as an avenue for giving and delighting in the giving. That's it's a great opportunity to contribute to the well-being of the whole group. It's not just something to get done so you can get on to the real practice, but it's something to be attentive to and learn from the different reactions that we have, or either the difficulty around it, or the. Or how to do it, or the uncertainty of how the heck am I supposed to do this? So, you know, those are reactions in the mind that we learn from. So that picking up those aspects of practice, also using as practice we're in retreat, other people are in retreat, paying attention to our mindfulness and clear comprehension in terms of how we, even if we're in silence, you know, we still interact with each other. So that having an attentiveness of, say, our proximity to each other, so that we're not unaware and, kind of intruding into people's space. There's a skill in learning how to move amongst each other. Like you're in the dining hall, and it isn't as if that the most efficacious way to get through the dining hall is in a straight path. So that you have to pay attention to the people around you. And it isn't just sort of bumping into them and bowling them over, but it's just, just giving each other space. That was something that Anagarshka John mentioned of the how at Abhayagiri, when he became an Anagarika, then he starts doing things in the monk's room. And, the monk's room is pretty tight. It's kind of narrow and tight. And it's not always a sterling example of mindfulness and sensitivity. But it's pretty good these days. And that's just because you're doing things, you're getting your stuff, you're washing bowls. It's a tight space and there's quite a few bodies. So that learning how to be attentive to each other. And so that in a retreat setting, particularly, it has that when one is sensitive and clear, then it has a very supportive feel. It's a gift to people to give each other space. Yeah, again, physical space, but then also the kind of one's own kind of energetic. So it's just bringing a kindness to our interactions. Also, just using the chanting as a meditation. It's an activity that we bring mindfulness to. And this one is just learning how to put effort and energy into the chanting. But a part of that is posture. With chanting, paying attention to your breathing. It's important because in the sense of you want to be able to be, when you're chanting, to be similarly as when you're meditating, somewhat upright so that your breathing is not constricted and then your chanting kind of flows along more easily. But then also, a lot of chanting is actually learning how to listen. Because it's not just us as an individual chanting. We're chanting with a whole group. And we can be energized by the chanting when we chant together. And I'm not criticizing. I've been quite impressed while people are chanting. But everybody seems to be actually on pitch, which is pretty good. There have been years, and it's a deadly combination when you have an enthusiastic chanter who is spectacularly off pitch. it's a workout. But that's where learning to listen is a part of chanting, and I can remember years ago going to Bodh Gaya, and in the evening time they do chanting. It's under the Bodhi tree. I mean, it's wonderful, incredibly auspicious, special situation under the Bodhi tree in the chedi, and they do the chanting, and it's broadcast over the. Over the loudspeakers, and there's all sorts of people inside the chedi, and there's people all around, and it's just all over the map. different styles of chanting, different voices, different... It's hard to not suffer. You know, so that using the chanting as a meditation, tuning into the breath, relaxing with it, oftentimes with chanting, having finished the chanting, and there's a real settled quality, or there can be a very settled quality to the mind. It's sort of energized, kind of settled. It's really a beautiful way to begin the meditation. And of course, what we're chanting about is all, it's all good stuff. So that there's this learning how to apply the teachings, apply the practice, apply the training into all the different aspects of our activities. And of course, in this period, the Thanksgiving retreat, monastic retreat, it's a way to learn how to gain those or hone those skills so that that can be taken out and applied to one's daily life in the world, because it's those are the skills that are really useful. The opportunity to be in retreat and settle and become peaceful is very precious as well, but it I think in terms of a long-term benefit is being able to gain a perspective that one can carry with one. And that's important, because the circumstances are not always what we like, prefer, are used to, or what we anticipate. And even if they are, we're still going to have to deal with change and difficulty of just aging. I'm thinking of it was a few years ago. I went to Thailand, and there's an old monk who lives near, he's passed away now, he lived near Ajahn Jayasaro. He's a British monk who most people probably know or have heard of. And he was a disciple, a student of Lumpa Tonglat, who was one of Ajahn Chah's teachers. And his name was Lumpu Tha. And I'd gone and visited and paid respects to him before with Ajahn Jayasaro, but that year he'd been in hospital and actually wasn't expected to survive. He was 96. He was very ill, and they didn't think he was going to recover, but he did, and he recuperated in the hospital for a while, and then came back to the monastery. And during the time that he was in the hospital and it looked like he was going to recuperate, then the lay people got together and did an extension on the his dwelling place, kind of a sala that he received guests at, and made it into kind of a little, like a hospital kuti, that they could look after him properly and that he could recuperate. So Ajahn Jayasaro and I showed up. We just heard that he was come back. He's back at his monastery. So we went to pay respects and to see him. And the lay people had gathered, and they were going to formally offer this sort of little hospital extension, nursing extension to the monastery. So we're sitting and waiting. It took a long time for him to come out, and I hadn't seen him since the previous year. So, and he was, he was 95, so he was old, but he was still, he was bright and in reasonably good health. But when he came out this time, then he was really kind of diminished. And he came out, and he really didn't look around much. His head was down, and he sat for a while, And you know, his head was down. And then the lay people started to say they're going to do this ceremony and taking the precepts, doing a formal offering ceremony. Nupo was, he just wasn't up for being it, so he had to lie down, and he still wasn't really engaging. So then Ajahn Jayasaro and I presided over the ceremony, and Nupo was just there, very quiet. And after the ceremony, then Ajahn Jayasaro and I came up, and Ajahn Jayasaro, who was very familiar with him, sort of said he was there and I was there, and that we just come to pay respects and see how he's doing after coming out of hospital, and just wanted to make sure he's doing he's doing okay, or seeing how he's doing. And that's when he opened his eyes, and just this incredible, bright, clear eyes, incredible clear voice. And he said, "It's all fine, it's all fine. Everything, every way." Yes, it was. Yes, I'm old and decrepit, and everything's falling apart, but everything's fine. So it's really, it's just, as we cultivate and practice and learn how to bring the Dhamma into all of our experiences. Yeah, it's just learning how to adapt gracefully to circumstances. It's sort of like, we get a toilet overflowing and Dhamma hall kind of flooded, and you say, what do you do? Well, you just adapt as gracefully as you can. Just deal with the circumstances with mindfulness, clear comprehension, alertness, and then things will fall into place. Because one of the things that we tend to do, especially on, say, on like meditation retreat, okay, I've got 10 days, my time's limited, I've really got to get the most out of it. And that, it can be a burden. Just learning how to relax, just learning how to be okay with whatever happens. And you can be okay because you can know it. And that's all that needs to be done. It can be known. It can be seen clearly. It can be understood. And it doesn't really matter whether it's praise or blame, gain or loss, happiness or suffering. That can all be known and understood and can be relinquished. It doesn't have to linger in the mind. Doesn't have to create a drama in the heart. It's just sort of as it is. There's a story of a meditator coming to a Tibetan teacher and asking the teacher, how can I get better meditative experiences and more of them too? how can I get these better meditative experiences? How can I meditate better? How can I? And the Tibetan teacher is kind of laughter and. Of course, as a Tibetan teacher, he's always going to have a mala nearby. He picks up his mala, and sort of it's like taking this mala and wanting it to stretch it and stretch it, so that it gets bigger and better. And of course, it's just going to break. He said, "It's just like that. You can't that sense of trying to get better and more." Meditative experiences is is not so important because, you know, they're going to change anyway. And, you know, it's as good as you can get them. They're going to change. They're impermanent. They're not stable. He said, what's more important is to gain confidence in the nature of awareness itself. That's what's really important. So that sense of you know, when we talk about carrying our practice with us, when you talk about being able to have Dhamma as refuge, it's that recognition of the there is this quality of the heart, of the mind, that has this knowing, and has the one who knows. It's that quality buddho, and the one who knows. That's the quality we want to be returning to. That's the quality we want to be giving importance to. And, you know, yes, obviously we're diligent in our meditation, but don't forget that spark of merit. And don't forget those acts of awareness and kindness around us. It's really that supports and nourishes our practice, and is, you know, to a certain degree, you know, it's kind of the essence of our practice. So that learning how to see through the kind of the machinations of the proliferating mind, because it just keeps cranking it out, and all you can do is just be patient and have a sense of humor. I mean, you know, for all of the things that we, you know, we want to hook into or to take exception to or to get excited about. You know, it's like one of the things that phrases that Ajahn Chah used to use. It's just that much. And in Thai, it's sort of, well, canon. It's just, you know, no big deal. It's nothing much. It's just that much. And so that being able to as we practice, as we meditate, as we incorporate the Dhamma, seeing the different ways that the mind reacts, and seeing the different things that get spun out of the mind, and it's just, you'll be able to say, oh, it's just that much. But then returning to that quality, being the one who knows, and take that as the refuge, take that as the heart of the practice.